Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. Hello, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners. My name is Rob Farley, and I have with me today Daniel Bester. Daniel and I have recorded two different podcasts, actually one long podcast that's divided in half. The first half of this, which you're about to listen to, is about Daniel's recent book on Hans Speier. Could you introduce yourself for the audience?
Sure. Well, my official title is the NHH and Kenneth B. Pyle, Assistant Professor in American Foreign Policy in the Jackson School of International Studies at, as you said, the University of Washington. But basically, I was trained as a historian, and I focus on the intellectual history of U.S. foreign policy, particularly on the transition between, you know, the 1930s and the 1960s, the U.S. rise to globalism, as some have termed it in the past, to a true globalism. And I'm currently working my first book, which will talk about was an intellectual biography of a man named Hans Speier, who was a sociologist who became the founding head of the RAND Corporation Social Science Division. And I'm currently working on a second book, which will be a real intellectual history of RAND itself from the founding until sometime after the founding.
So let's start with, we're going to go a lot of places in this conversation, but why don't we start with your previous book, the first book, The Democracy in Exile book, which is about Hans Speier, who is not a figure that most people are really familiar with, but that foreign policy, you know, people who read your book and people who are familiar with conversations about it perhaps should be more familiar with. So could you tell a little bit, I mean, I guess start by telling a little bit about his story, who he was and how he found his way from Germany to RAND?
Sure. So just to basically situate it just slightly in the literature so people get a sense. So there's a big question, at least to me, is why did intellectuals become so involved with national security policymaking during and after World War II? And so a lot of the explanations have been essentially structural. It's right. The United States has this huge military force that is creating in World War II. It needs experts to manage these forces after World War II. It has a new global presence. It needs area knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. But what I wanted to do was to examine why intellectuals themselves felt compelled to basically abandon academia and join the American national security state or the emergent national security state. And what I did was that I wanted to trace someone who's not your typical, you know, what one might refer to as a conservative or centrist, but someone who really moved from the left to embrace elements of what became the national security state. And as I was doing research, I came across this guy named Hans Speier, who was very much a social democrat in the Weimar Republic, and then became really, I think, the intellectual instantiation of Cold War liberalism in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So just a brief biography, Speier was born in 1905 in the end of the German Empire. He comes of age really in the 1920s. He very early on aligns himself with the Social Democratic Party of Germany, which is really the party that presents itself as the bulwark of the Weimar Republic, which is being attacked on the right from various conservative nationalists and eventually the Nazis, and on the left from the Communist Party, which had split off from the socialists earlier in the earlier in the century. And he is also the first student of Karl Mannheim, who is not super well known today, but he was very influential in his time. Particularly, he developed this methodology called the sociology of knowledge, which connected one's ideas to their position within a particular class society, but was also a very influential writer on intellectuals, in that he argued, namely, that intellectuals were uniquely socially positioned to stand above all ideologies and come to a sort of total perspective that could guide German politics forward. So Speier is this guy Mannheim's first student. He's actually not Jewish, but he marries a Jewish pediatrician. And when Hitler comes to power in 1933, he is forced to go into exile, both for his politics, his left-wing politics as a socialist, and because he's married to a Jewish pediatrician. But what's really interesting is that over the course of the late Weimar Republic, roughly from 1929 to 1933, Speier undergoes a political conversion where he initially argues that intellectuals need to align themselves with the Socialist Party and really work towards socialist transformation. By the time Hitler succeeds in 1933, he argues that intellectuals need to use their powers to essentially defeat Hitler and that they can no longer trust the public. So essentially, between 1929 and 1933, there's he becomes progressively disillusioned with what I call in the book ordinary people, and argues that essentially they really can't be trusted. They're too ignorant. They don't know enough about politics, and that basically intellectuals need to guide society. And this is the ideas that he brings with him when he comes to the United States. And it's pretty useful for him because he's entering an American culture that is defined, I think, around this famous debate between John Dewey and Walter Lippmann concerning the role of the public in policymaking and really the role of the expert in policymaking. And Lippmann argues that, like Speier, he argues that experts can't trust the public, while Dewey argues that, no, any democracy that doesn't rely on public opinion isn't a democracy at all. And though Dewey admits that public opinion isn't where it should be, that you needed to actually make public opinion better. But Speier aligns with Lippmann, and I think this really becomes a consensus position of the generation of intellectuals that enter and create the national security state during and after World War II. The idea that you cannot trust ordinary people to not only not make decisions. Obviously, we live in a representative democracy, not a direct democracy, but also to serve as a guide for decision making. And I think that is basically one of the fundamental ideological assumptions of the entire edifice of American foreign policy making to emerge during and after World War II that had previously been ignored in the literature. And then just to wrap up here, Speier basically brings this ideology with him to the Rand Corporation and helps found its social science division, where people like Bernard Brody and William Kaufman found a home in the 1950s. And I think that Rand is really undergirded again by this ideology that they are able to exist as an extra state institution that is, of course, very much connected to the state, but it's based a clerisy, right? A clerisy that comes up with their own ideas, that uses them to inform policymaking without any reference at all to public opinion, which I argue emerges from this interwar experience.
Right. And so, in a sense, I mean, there are two things. So first, I read the book, and I think the book is outstanding. It's tremendously fascinating with respect both to the intellectual development of Speier himself, but also into sort of how Speier fits into this emergence of this nascent national security state. And then, I mean, and you follow up through basically the end of his career, and he becomes less sort of personally important over the course of the early Cold War, until he's sort of the old timer who's kind of hanging around. But they still ask him interesting questions now and again. And just the way you described it, also, have you read Moshe Gessen's The Future is History by any chance?
Yes.
Yes. Just the way you described sort of Rand's social science vision, but also then the development of sociology in Germany, just evoked for me a lot of thinking about the difficulties of Soviet sociology that she describes in the first part of her book, right? That it was just such a struggle for sort of Soviet academia to figure anything else or anything out about the Soviet Union and about the people of the Soviet Union, because certain subjects were verboten, right? And so I guess all this implies is that there's a lot of sort of interesting intellectual cross-pollination when you start reading books.
Right. Together. And I think one of the fundamental problems of modernity, essentially, right, and the fundamental problems of mass politics, which is really what we're still dealing with in the last 100 years, right? You have this total transformation in that people finally have the capacities, one, to be informed, and two, to affect decisions and mobilize in ways that they were never able to before. So I actually don't think there's that big a difference between sort of, let's say, the organization that took place in Tahrir Square during the so-called Arab Spring and what happened in Germany, sort of mass mobilizations in the 1920s, and sort of the question is, how do you deal with this sort of basically newly online mass politics, and how does one as an expert both create these publics as objects of inquiry, but also deal with them as political objects in themselves? And of course, we see this right now with all of the hand wringing over so-called populism, which is not a term that I love, because I think it obscures more than it illuminates. But I think you're essentially dealing with this a very similar problem. And I think you actually see it. I don't know if you recall, but after Trump was elected, there was a very well-known cartoon from The New Yorker going around where there was a guy who was very clearly a member of the white working class standing up on a plane, essentially saying that, why are we letting the pilot fly? I know better, right? So there's a fundamental skepticism, I think, of democratic publics in a lot of liberal thinking. Capital, you know, L, mid-19th century liberal thinking, but also, you know, the liberal instantiation.
All right. I mean, let's pause here and then step back a little bit, right? So first, I'm very much on board, sort of, with this notion that there are sort of aspects of the one that this national security state that we've created that dominates so much of our lives, right? That dominated so much of our lives up until 1989, and then, despite everyone's best wishes, continued to dominate our lives past 1989. I mean, but this is not an either or thing, right? There has to be. We really are on a, and it's sort of the knowledge, the discussion of populism and so forth. And there's been lots of stuff about, you know, Tom Nichols has his book on the death of expertise and so forth, right? But I mean, Speier is there is the. What's interesting for Speier is that he sees everything sort of go badly in Weimar, right? And that's what sort of generates, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but that's sort of what generates this deep level of skepticism he has, both about the ability of democracy to survive inside of a country, but also about sort of more generally, and this is what kind of generates his attitudes eventually towards both Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, this skepticism, which was also captured by folks like Hans Morgenthau, about the ability of democracies to resist autocracies, right? And both of those things are going on in his thought, and they're not exactly the same, but they're pretty similar. But is that right? Do you think that he had both of those levels of skepticism, both internal and external, about democracy?
I think that's exactly right. And I think it's important that you mentioned Morgenthau because he's coming from almost the opposite political position. Morgenthau, I think, is from pretty early on a conservative, at least in the most meaningful senses. And Speier very much is not. But what's interesting about Weimar is that people across the political spectrum arrive at this convergent position about the exactly as you frame it, sort of a position that is very skeptical of democracy, both internally and externally as well. I think you characterize it exactly right.
Okay. So sort of starting with my own position, and it's also interesting that the both of us have, I mean, you're at the Jackson School at the University of Washington, I'm at the Patterson School at the University of Kentucky, right? And so both the Jackson School and the Patterson School have, as part of their mission sets, something that goes beyond what we would treat as sort of the classic academic department, right, which has specific responsibilities to undergraduates, but also responsibility to produce scholarly work, right? Both Jackson and Patterson, and really, I mean, both of them, as part of their mission sets, have an engagement directly with the public aspect of what they're supposed to be doing, right? Which is why the Jackson School is named after Scoop Jackson, right? Because he wanted sort of direct engagement with the public and informing the public about things about foreign policy. And the Patterson School here in Kentucky has the same mission as the Jackson School. Speier's not wrong in an important way, right? I mean, I guess I'll just sort of throw that out in the sense. And like in reading the book over, I'm not sure that you ever really sort of – did you ever really sort of engage? Well, you know, here's Speier's attitude about the public and democracy. There is an insight into democratic politics and the relationship of democratic politics with foreign policy that – Speier sort of really grips, and it's the reason that Speier and Morgenthau, a lot of them sort of come to these same conclusions about this relationship between democracy and sort of really technical areas of public policy, of which foreign policy is one, right? And so we can put Morgenthau and Speier sort of more on a continuum of this relationship between democracy and expert, sort of rather, which has to be a continuum, which everybody sort of has to accept that, or maybe we don't have to accept, that in a sense there can be no real democratic foreign policy, right? Democratic or foreign policy is something that sort of inherently so technical and complex that it defies democracy. Does that make any sense?
Yes, I see that position. I think a couple of things. I don't think it's actually that technical and that complex. I think that there's been a lot of sort of hand waving around the sort of complexities of foreign policy. I think a lot of it is actually quite common sense. And I think one of the problems with political science is that as a discipline, it has to make it seem a bit more complex than it is in order to justify its very existence. And Michael Desch talks a bit about this in his recent book called The Irrelevance. But even I would agree that there are certain elements, you know, certain elements of treaty formulation or institutional formulation or diplomacy that, of course, are very technical and complex, and that they do need to be run by experts. And but even beyond that, I think that you experts beyond the technical proficiency or the technocratic aspects, not everyone needs to devote their lives to specific issues of foreign policy. And I think you need experts in that way. And I think Bruce Kuklick in his book Blind Oracles has a great quote. I'm going to paraphrase, but he essentially says if you don't use social science, and what he really means is expertise, if you don't use it, then you rely on habit, authority, or chance, which isn't good. I think you do need expertise, and I'm very much not someone who wants to reject expertise. But where I would disagree with Speier, or I think if I'm understanding him correctly, someone like Tom Nichols, is that they don't quite admit the almost total failures of experts as well. I mean, experts have contributed to some of the worst foreign policy disasters, not only in American history, but I would say world history, you know, going from Vietnam to Iraq being two of the most prominent examples. But I would even say at this point, from the vantage point of 2019, and as a historian of the Cold War, I truly believe the Cold War could have ended in the 1950s after Stalin, and that it didn't, primarily because of experts arguing in favor of particular policies. So it contributed to really disastrous decisions. So then this leads to the problem, right? I agree with Speier that you can't rely on the public in all of these ways, and that in many instances, the public, for a variety of reasons, I think primarily material and structural reasons, can be manipulated to various degrees. But then on the other side, you have experts who repeatedly make terrible foreign policies. So the question is, in a democracy, how do you exert some sort of meaningful democratic control of experts while also providing experts with the latitude to make foreign policies that rely on their particular forms of knowledge and their particular forms of expertise? I don't think this tension is ultimately transcendable into some sort of synthesis. I think this is ultimately one of the ineluctable tensions that lie at the heart of modern of policymaking in a basically a post-industrial, especially service-driven democracy like our own. But I think that the ledger is pretty bad on the expert side. So then what do you do with that? And I think this is really a problem that the next generation of foreign policy thinkers is going to have to take more seriously, especially because I don't think we as a discipline and we as a profession, if we're thinking of ourselves as foreign policy professionals, have paid nearly enough attention to the institutional arrangements of foreign policy making, which have essentially remained relatively static since the late 1940s. And obviously, things have changed since the late 1940s, and I think we need to come up with a meaningful institutional solutions to the problems that are only really beginning to be identified in a coherent way.
It's really interesting. I mean, sort of what you said there, I mean, I am inclined on the one hand to grant this notion that, yes, experts have made these sort of disastrous and these and they are disastrous policies that are in a way that are sort of clearly traceable. It goes beyond just sort of experts making mistakes too, right? The ways in which expertise are concentrated and formulated, you can track serious critical foreign policy errors and sort of even broader, more public policy errors to the way that we construct and formulate and concentrate expertise, right, in foreign policy affairs, right? And so, but at the same time, I'm curious how we go about assessing what, for the lack of a better term, we would call the batting average of foreign policy experts, right? And how we would compare that. And I understand you're not posing this sort of either or here, because, you know, and I definitely also tend to agree with this notion. I mean, what Speier is doing here, right, is he is taking, as Speier and people like them want to take public policy out of even the grand strategic aspect of, or they want to take public opinion out of even the grand strategic aspect of foreign policy making, right? So you set up institutions that will ensure a Cold War and that will ensure that the Cold War is fought, even if people don't really sort of seriously want to do it. And if they don't want to do it, you'll make them do it because you'll set up institutions that are able to manage public opinion and are able to channel public opinion in particular ways, creating this sort of reality so people understand the Cold War as sort of this thing that is solid and has to be.
One quick tangent. I think what Speyer did, I think that's an element you're saying, but what Speyer did specifically was to create institutions that totally stood outside normal democratic politics. So it wasn't even involving manipulating public opinion. Public mm-hmm. opinion wasn't a factor. Sorry to interrupt.
No. I mean, that makes sense. Although, yeah, I mean, there's quibbling on either side of that, but that completely makes sense to me. So, thinking a little bit more about what, for lack of a better word, is the batting average of foreign policy experts, and in particular, foreign policy experts who were associated with the Cold War, which obviously Speyer is, but then there's a wide variety of other experts that we know, from Paul Nitze to George Kennan to essentially all of the experts associated with the nuclear weapons and the nuclear weapons community and the grand strategic communities. The way you've characterized it in a way that I think a lot of the listeners are going to be really sympathetic with is that sort of this community of experts and sort of communities of foreign policy experts have made some pretty dreadful errors, and we should be really reluctant to turn over our foreign policy to them. But you know, if we had the ghost of Speyer with us today, or the ghost of Paul Nitze, they might say something along the lines of, you know, look, in 1947, everyone thought that the world was going to end in a nuclear inferno, that whatever mistakes we may have made, whatever mistakes the strategic community may have made in fomenting the Cold War and pursuing the Cold War, it did two things essentially right. And the two things it did right were the biggest, most important things that anyone would have identified in 1947. And those were the prevention of nuclear war, right? That we never wedged a nuclear war that destroyed humanity. And second, that whether or not the Cold War had to happen in the way it did, the way it actually did happen led to the destruction of an awful regime that was rotten to the core. Now, I think there's ample room for pushback on both of these, but you know, I mean, Speyer and Nitze and so forth have an argument on those two cases, I think.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good way to frame it. And I just want to say that I'm much more sympathetic and empathetic to what I term the first generation of defense intellectuals, people like Kennan, people like Speyer, and people like Nitze, who I really do think lived through really world-ending catastrophes, like the collapse of the Weimar Republic and the rise of Hitler in particular. And I think the rise of Hitler really traumatized, understandably, a generation of foreign policy thinkers. And it really shaped how they view geopolitics in a fundamental way, where they did view geopolitics in a Manichaean way, because Hitler truly was a Manichaean enemy. He truly was evil. He truly was bent on destruction of the European continent and conquest of the European continent in a serious way. So it makes sense to me why someone like Speyer, why someone like Kennan, two people who were in Berlin, for example, during the rise of the Nazis, would then analogize the Soviet Union with Nazi Germany, and specifically Stalin with Hitler, especially because Stalin was also a brutal dictator. So I completely empathize as a historian why they made the choices they did in 1947. I think that makes a lot of sense. Why they constructed the national security state, why they were skeptical of public opinion. You know, the public voted for Hitler, or at least not voted necessarily, but supported Hitler. I think these were semi-reasonable conclusions to reach. The problem is that they fundamentally misunderstood the nature of the institutionalization project that they were undertaken. So what Speyer argues in particular over the course of the late 1940s and early 1950s is that once the quote-unquote world crisis ended, and he really meant essentially once the United States beat the Soviet Union in the Cold War, that life would return to normal. You'd have a return to normalcy, mm-hmm. to sort of echo the Warren G. Harding post-World War II War One, the political slogan. But the problem is they didn't really realize what was going on with institutionalization and how institutional and perhaps even more importantly, intellectual inertia would take hold. What actually happens, of course, after the end of the Cold War is you get what I've termed, I'm sure other people have termed this as well, the Cold War on steroids, where a lot of the logics of the Cold War and literally the people who were raised in the Cold War continued to define American foreign policy and, in fact, continue to define American foreign policy if you look at, you know, a lot of the high-ranking members, not only in the Trump administration but also in the Obama administration, people like Hillary Clinton, people like Bob Gates, a worldview entirely shaped by the Cold War, and I think it led to a lot of perversions of American foreign policy. But the question then is I think, as you gestured toward, did we need the Cold War to avert a nuclear war? And I don't think that you do. That the Cold War could have actually ended much earlier, I think, as early as Stalin's death in March 1953 and as late as the Geneva Conference in 1955. I think that Khrushchev and other Soviet leaders were, I think the historical record is showing ever more so, were willing to make a deal in the 1950s. And it was particular ideological blinders on behalf of the United States that prevented that and led to this decades-long Cold War, which I think was defined by a massive waste of resources. Plus, I think it's important to emphasize that books like Paul Chamberlain's recent book on the Cold War, sort of challenging John Lewis's long peace theory, essentially showed that over the course of the Cold War, approximately 20 million people died in Cold War conflicts for an average of about 1,200 people a day for 45 years. And of course, the blame for that can't be laid entirely at the feet of the United States. The Soviet Union had a lot to do with that as well. But I do think if we're, you know, hindsight is 2020, of course, but I do think the United States is quote unquote more responsible for the Cold War because I think it's just far more powerful in the Soviet Union for the majority of the history of the Cold War. And I think that if the United States was more willing to make deals earlier on, we could have avoided a lot of the Cold War conflict.
Well, I mean, I think that's one we would actually have to come back to at some point. I mean, I think that's a question that's far larger than this sort of the assessment of the responsibility for the Cold War. The assessment for the wisdom of the Cold War is, I think, far too large of a question to deal with, sort of with the time that we have for us right now. I mean, it is interesting, and I was recently, I've just spent the last year at the Army War College, and so I got to review a lot of, and we taught in class a number of the sort of the documents around that were associated with the beginning of the Cold War, and you know there is a lot of give even in documents, sort of the classic NSC-68 and so forth documents about what Soviet intentions look like and about how Soviet intentions can be managed, can be finessed, and even Nitsa, right, sort of is open. You know, there is dispute even among the strategic thinkers about what exactly the Soviets want from all of this. And that, I mean, that lasts until the 1970s. So there is a certain logic there. You know, I'm not sure it's useful, I guess, from my point of view, to say that one side is more responsible for the Cold War, right? I suppose you could make the argument that American decision makers could have chosen differently, whereas Soviet decision makers could not have chosen differently given the hostility of the United States.
And I think we're learning that's true the more and more we learn about internal Soviet deliberations. I think that there was, from what we know, there was far more give on the Soviet side than the Americans were willing to accept. And they misread cues. I mean, I know specifically because I'm writing an article on it on the Geneva Conference of 55. The Soviets were really ready to make a deal, and Eisenhower went into that conference totally unwilling to make a deal and was advised by people like Speer, actually, and people like Walt Rostow that he should use the conference solely as a psychological warfare campaign as opposed to actually, you know, make a deal with the Soviet Union. But this gets into very specific historical details.
Right. But I think the people were also cognizant at the time that there was no – right. And whether this supports your case, I think it probably actually supports your argument, right, that, you know, there was an evangelical aspect to it on the part of the United States that, you know, we are sort of less or that sort of cuts both ways, right? That any sort of deal that preserved the existence of the Soviet Union preserved the existence of what people believed was a truly foul regime, right? Whether it was a regime that was imperialist in the same sense as Nazi Germany, it nevertheless was a regime that was at the least bent on the domination of its immediate neighborhood. And that certainly cut for the policymakers at the time in the 1950s, I think.
Right. I think that's fair. And I mean, I'm of the opinion that communism is actually far less important to the Cold War than people have supposed, that it was much less an ideological struggle. I mean, it became that, but I think it's in its origins in the late 1940s, it was far less about ideology and far more about this incorrect analogizing of the Soviet Union with Nazi Germany for understandable reasons, given the previous 30 years of experience that these people literally had. But I think that in retrospect, we could see that it was a misapplication of a very powerful historical analogy that, of course, still resonates in our own political discourse today.
Okay. Well, then, why don't we wrap up this part, and we will come back, and LGM listeners, we will come back next week with the second half of this podcast, which, as I suggested, is going to turn its attention towards the question of what sort of a modern progressive foreign policy ought to look like and what some of the pitfalls. I think we're going to try to draw some lessons from this first half and apply them in the second half, but we are going to mainly wrap up on Speyer and then talk more about a contemporary context next week. So, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. And LGM listeners, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.